Okay, hi. I think I'm talking about the hollow men of New Zealand politics. I think that's what I've been asked to talk about, in particular about Labour and National. So, obviously, The Hollow Men is a book by Nikki Hagar that came out late last year, and I'm not going to talk about the book a lot, but just a few points about it briefly in terms of this speech. I think it's a great book, and I do recommend it to anyone who hasn't read it. Fascinating insight to party politics in New Zealand. But there are some problems with it. There's a few weaknesses. Hagar's very good at illustrating the hollowness of New Zealand politics, and that's why you should read it, because he does present a very good account of the sad and exhausted state of one political party. He proves it exists, he condemns it, and he seeks to understand it. But I think he's at loss to understand what it's really about. I don't think Hagar really understands that there's a new consensus in New Zealand politics, a new centre. So at the end of the talk, after looking at Labour and National, I'll look at some of the reasons why I think there's now a hollowness to New Zealand politics. Just a second weakness with Hagar's book is that he ends up condemning the National Party rather than the New Zealand party system as a whole. This isn't necessarily his intention or his fault, but that's certainly the public perception of the book. People think it's an expose on the National Party and an expose on Don Brash, and I don't really think that's what the book is necessarily intended to do. I mean, Hagar's already said that he'd like to do a similar book on the Labour Party, and he has done Seeds of Distrust, which, although it is ostensibly about GM corn and so forth, it's really looking at the media manipulation of the Labour government. So that's also worth reading. Thirdly, I think Hagar gets the National Party and the story of Don Brash quite wrong. He paints a picture of a successful right-wing takeover of the party, and how Brash nearly got into power, and how he would have unleashed a whole new Rogernomics. I don't really find that account totally convincing. I think the evidence that Hagar produces in the book actually shows a different story. It's a story of Don Brash actually being bringing into power into a hollow party, and with his advisers, and his advisers actually pushing him into being pragmatic and selling out his core beliefs and making him something that he wasn't. He had to slowly but surely capitulate and moderate on virtually every part of his beliefs. He had to drop unpopular issues and de-emphasise certain issues. And the problem I have with the debate, to what extent it's actually happened around in the book, is this idea, and about Brash, is that he had all these hidden agendas, and although he moderated on certain things, once he got into power, he was going to do all these really extreme right-wing things. And that's kind of like when the right-wing say about left-wing parties, like the Alliance or the Greens, they say, oh, look, they've moderated on this, they've given away this tax policy, they've moved to the centre, but they're not really. They're just keeping that for when they get into power, and when the Labour government get into power, they're going to nationalise everything, and when the Alliance get into power, they're going to turn New Zealand into a communist country. It's the same version. It's the left doing what the right wing normally do. And I think things are a bit more complex. But we can talk about that afterwards. So I'm just going to talk briefly about National and Labour and how I think they've moved towards the centre. Now, when I talk about a centre in politics, I'm not saying that Labour and National are all very moderate and more left-wing than they used to be. I'm saying that there's a new centre of politics. Politics has moved to the right, and now there's a new consensus. So it's far to the right of what it used to be in the mid-80s, but nonetheless, it's a new consensus. So I'll just talk about National first, and about John Key. I think that John Key definitely has moved the party to a more moderate stance compared to what they used to be. Even before he became leader, he played a strong role in pushing National further into the centre, getting National to adopt the superannuation fund of the Labour government, ensuring that National's proposed tax cuts weren't actually focused on the rich, but were focused on the middle class. And then, of course, after the election, you know, Key popped up with all these apparent moderate statements on racial issues, talking about tolerance, talking like a Labour Party politician, talking about inclusiveness, saying that he celebrated the Maori Renaissance. The whole tone was different to the old brash. And I think we have to take that into account if we're going to analyse modern politics. National's position towards the Murray seats has changed. Key, I think, has a very genuine and smart intention of building bridges with other parties. One of the problems with Brash was that he couldn't build bridges with the other parties, and although it appeared that he nearly won the election in 2005, he didn't really have the coalition partners, so he was actually a lot further away from winning than people sometimes suggest. All he had was ACT, and he hadn't built the bridges, whereas that's what he's doing now. He's doing building bridges with the Greens and the Māori parties, New Zealand First and United. And that's why there is a very good chance that, that we'll have a national government next year. So Key has moved on climate change. He's made a big shift on nuclear ship visits and put that old bogey to rest. He's been reaching out to the gay community, to solo parents. I mean, even if you look at the shadow cabinet, you'll see that people like Catherine Rich has been brought back onto the front bench. Previously, she'd been ditched by Brash after she was in disagreement with Brash about the Ariwa speech. Key has brought back in Georgina to Huhu, and he's reinstated her as the Māori Affairs spokesperson. People like Simon Power has jumped in the caucus rankings from number 7 to 4. And, of course, you've got Bill English replacing the buffoonish, what's his name, Jerry Brownlee, as the deputy. And if you start looking at some of the policies like in industrial relations, National's making a real effort to show that they're not extreme, that they're the same as Labour to some extent. They've said that they won't basically change the Employment Relations Act. In some ways, they're quite honest about this. They say that Labour's rewriting of the Employment Contracts Act was really kept the old legislation in terms of 85%, so that they're not terribly unhappy with this current industrial relations, which I think says a lot about where Labour is also at. In terms of tax cuts, Bill English talks about how National would only cut taxes as and when it becomes affordable and responsible. And National have said they don't want tax cuts to be an election issue. And if you look at the new MPs that came in the last election, you've got some rising stars like Jackie Blue, Chris Finlayson, Chester Burrows, and they're all sort of the future of the Labour Party. They're moderates. There was a profile done on each of these in the Herald a few months ago, and I was asking them, you know, what was their political nature, and they all made all the more moderate rhetoric about wanting to be a centre party and how National's moving back to the centre. And they talked about their favourite MPs being people like Tariana Turia, Peter Sharples, Sue Bradford and Nandor Tanchos. So it's quite amazing. And then you've got things like market rents and housing. National's basically ditched that. They still believe in it, but they've ditched it because they know that they... That policy is outside the new consensus. In terms of unions, Nationals now say that they love unions. They say that they want to draw a line between the old union-bashing National Party and now the more sophisticated middle-of-the-road National Party. And so the new spokesperson is Kate Wilkinson, and you know, she's at real pains to show that National want to have a constructive relationship with unions. National now say that they value unions and they believe that unions have an important role to play in representing workers. So, I mean, obviously that's all rhetoric, but it does mean something. It shows that they're not that different to Labour, who also say the same sort of thing. It doesn't mean that they're going to be worker-friendly, just in the same way that Labour's not worker-friendly. And, I mean, it does say a lot that... Kate Wilkinson says those sorts of things, whereas the last spokesperson, Wayne Mapp, was, you know, had vitriol about unions. You know, he absolutely hated them and couldn't say anything nice about them. So I think that's quite significant. And so all these National Party changes really mirror what's happening. Well, they're the same thing as what's happening in the UK with the Conservative Party. So I think we can learn a lot from what's happening there. And the left over there have been trying to say that the new Conservative Party leader is basically a wolf in sheep's clothing, and that really he's a right-winger, and as soon as he gets into power, he's going to be Thatcher again. And that hasn't worked. No one actually believes the left when they keep on using that sort of argument. And so again, I think in New Zealand, it's not going to get us anywhere if we're just going around saying John Key, as people like Chris Trotter and lots of other people on the left, just keep on saying John Key is just brash and drag. That's actually not true. And I think we're just not facing reality if we're pretending that National are far to the right of Labour. Okay, so now I'll just talk briefly about the Labour Party and the Labour government. Since Labour's been in, business profits have been up 54%, and that's under a Labour government. And obviously wages, because as the comrade from Australia was talking about, there's been a bit of an economic boom in Australia and New Zealand, and it's interesting to see who's benefiting from the boom. Because likewise, even under a so-called Labour government, it's business that's making the money out of the boom. So 54% up is quite significant. So a lot of business really aren't actually that unhappy with Labour. But here we have got very mild increases in wages, which have actually been negated by fast rising prices in lots of areas, fast rising housing prices, etc. So it'd be hard pushed to make an argument that workers have benefited from the economic boom here under Labour. So even some of Labour's so-called better progressive policies, like working for families, when you actually look into the detail of them, you'll find that they're not nearly as progressive as they make out. Basically, working for families is a state subsidy for business. It means that they can pay poverty wages and the state will top up those poverty wages. And then there's things like Work for Dole, which we thought had long gone a few years ago. It was a National Party policy. But then the Māori Party bring it up and they've adopted it as their policy. And then National re-adopts it, and now Labour are actually introducing it. So with the passage of the Social Security Amendment Bill, we're finding that there's much more harsher penalties for job seekers that won't accept any old job that they're told to take. So we'll see the negatives of that in a few months when it finally comes into force. And then, of course, on things outside the country, like the war on terror, New Zealand's participation in it is as much as you could expect from any government. And not long ago, the Labour government announced that they're going to spend another $30 million keeping 130 New Zealand troops in Afghanistan. And echoing George Bush's slogan that it's a war without end, Clark said that New Zealand's going to be there for a few more years yet. New Zealand actually has, amongst non-NATO countries, has the second highest per capita military contribution to the occupation of Afghanistan. And Phil Goff, the defence minister, has said that they'd like to send even more troops to Afghanistan, but they need to keep a certain contingent at home in case there's a military need to intervene in places like East Timor. So, this is a Labour government. I challenge anyone to make out on even something like defence that there's a big difference between Labour and National. In terms of defence spending, even something that has been quite a traditional indicator of the difference between Labour and National's priorities, you'll find that throughout the 90s, National actually cut defence expenditure. It actually declined, whereas under Labour, it's had its biggest growth ever. The Labour Party have had a a policy of an $8 billion increase in spending. And so you won't often hear National complaining about defence spending anymore or what Labor's doing in terms of defence, because they're doing more so than National's ever done. And so talking about the gap between rich and poor, talking about incomes, part of the problem is welfare benefits. Labor's never shown any interest in reversing the benefit cuts, that were made because the state said it couldn't afford to pay them anymore, had to cut back. But now we have surpluses, now the government has a lot of money, it's still not interested in doing so. And so research at University of Auckland up on the hill had a look at social security payments over the decades, and they found that compared to the average wage, benefits have been cut 45% since 86. Sorry, no, that's not quite right. Benefits used to be 45% of the average wage, and now they're down to 28% of the average wage. If you look at something like health, we've got a very much a decaying public health system, which Labor came into power on a huge campaign that it was going to fix the situation. And as everyone knows, from a patient's point of view, it hasn't been fixed. The public still faces the dilemma of growing waiting lists, the unavailability of basic operations, increased involvement in the public sector by the private health sector, and wildly variable treatments, prospects of treatments in different parts of the country. It's a postcode lottery. In the West Coast, you'll have, maybe a good chance of getting a hip replacement. In Auckland, you'll have much less or whatever. There's no universality. And last year, 35,000 people were removed from the surgery waiting lists, not because they are well, but because the Labor government wanted to kick them off to make the waiting lists look better. In the last quarter of last year, there was a big jump in health insurance taken out by individuals, and it's now up to 1.37 million. So that's a vote of no confidence in the health system. Things like electricity is increasingly unaffordable to the general public. Labor also came in to government promising to fix that. It spent a lot of time telling people how bad the electricity market was and how National had stuffed it up. But since 2000, power prices have gone up by 40%. And just over the last year, our electricity prices have risen by 7% for domestic consumers, but they've gone up 7%, but for businesses they've gone down by 6.5%. There were some stats out recently to show where New Zealand's wealth is, and it shows that the top 10%, the top 10 wealthiest percent of New Zealanders now own 52% of the country. So that's an incredible figure. But even more incredible, that's up from 48%. So the richest 10% used to own 48% of the country, now they own 52% under a Labor government. Housing. Everyone's heard about how unaffordable housing is. In a place like here in Auckland, workers on the average wage have to pay 90% of their wage to be able to afford the average priced house. Obviously completely unaffordable. The rate of home ownership in New Zealand is plummeting fast. And of course, Labor and National both have a hands-off approach to this. They say, let the market rule. If people can't afford to buy houses, that's it. We're not going to build lots more state houses. National sold off about 13,000 state houses in the 1990s. Since then, Labor have built about 7,000. So they haven't even built as many state houses that were sold off. And they're not interested in doing any mass program of state houses. Instead, Labor talks about wanting private housing to be built in poor areas as the answer to the solution. Even if you look at something like ACC, the Labor Party also campaigned to get into government by how crappy ACC has been under a National government. and they said that they'd save it, but that's clearly not the case. It's the value of ACC has strongly eroded. ACC was set up as sort of a social contract between workers, the state, and business, whereby workers would forego their right to be able to sue if they're damaged at work or in any private situation. They gave that up in order to be able to get generous compensation payments from the government. But because it's been eroded so much, now those payments are so small that workers actually would have been better off if they were still able to sue. I'll give you an example. I heard about a few weeks ago, a woman on the West Coast, 29 years old. She had osteoporosis, so had a bad knee, had to wait 5 years for a knee operation. She was, you know, crippled for 5 years. Finally got the knee operation. It was a routine operation. It was botched up. They amputated her leg because of it. And ACC finally paid her out and gave her $6,000 for the loss of a leg and for loss of future earnings resulting to that, etc., which is quite incredible. And that just gives you an indication of how healthy ACC is now. And then, of course, a couple of weeks ago, we had the 2007 budget. And there's just a couple of brief points about that. A lot of people talk about, or a lot of the right talk about how much Labor is now spending, but the fact is, as a proportion of GDP, which is the figure you take if you really want to look at the size of the state, you look at expenditure as a proportion of GDP. At the moment, under Cullen, it's 33%. It was actually higher than when Ruth Richardson was the finance minister. So this Labor government spends less than National did. And Labor's new initiatives, things like KiwiSaver, I won't get into that in big detail, but it's essentially an extra tax on workers. And it's the start of a privatisation of social security. And it's, again, something we need to fight. And then their other big proposal, or their other big implementation, is business tax cuts. They've cut taxes for corporations by 10%. Even National wouldn't do that throughout the 1990s. The last government to cut taxes in New Zealand was the Labor government back in the 80s. So just to get on to explaining some of that phenomena, if I've got time, am I going okay for time? Sorry, I'm not sure. Okay, well. So my argument is that pragmatism and electoral calculations shape political culture today more than ever. And we can't actually understand party politics just by reference to left and right, Labor being left, National being right, etc. And my argument is that there's a number of interconnected influences that has brought about this current state of party politics. I think the most obvious one is the last two or three decades of economic slump and social decay. It's undermined the possibility of any party that is running the show being able to do anything of substance. And then there's a lot of interconnected other things, like the end of the Cold War. No longer do we have those poles, such strong poles of capitalism and so-called communism. And that's had its influence on party systems throughout the world. But the increasing blandness of political parties, I think, can be especially attributed to the suspension of collective class conflict in New Zealand. We're seeing less class conflict, and we're seeing less class conflict that operates with, is transferred through to the party system. So it means that parties now have more in common than they have differences. So just talk about some of those economic changes. I think basically we now have a political impasse that is merely matching the economic impasse. We've got an exhausted economic system, really. Although you can have booms and stuff, it doesn't translate in the way that it used to into positive results for everyone. So we can locate this strange state of politics now in the shortcomings of the capitalist system. Whenever political parties aspire to manage the affairs of capitalism, they have to therefore tailor their programs to what is actually possible under that system. They're constrained by the fact that economy goes up and down, constrained even more importantly by the fact that business and the rich want increasingly to achieve their profits, especially when you've got situations of declining profitability. There's also very much a social fragmentation in New Zealand. You know, increasingly we have an individualised society where there's a lot more social breakdown, and therefore we don't actually have a strong class struggle occurring in society. We want to make that happen, obviously, with things like the Workers' Party and Unite, but we have to accept that it's actually not. We haven't got thousands of people coming onto the streets whenever National or Labour do anything bad. We've got unions that don't really function like they used to. We haven't really got the strong societal institutions that we used to have. And my argument is that, because you used to have a National Party that was based strongly on business and farming and the middle class, and you had a Labour Party, for all its faults, was a lot more strongly connected to the union movement and based on the votes of working class voters, these parties had to actually reflect that class struggle and reflect class differences that happen in society. But now those links between class and party and the lower levels of class conflict are so much weaker, it means that parties, although they always had elements of pragmatism, they weren't always the dominant thing, but now they are. So there's no pressure on Labour to be a left-wing party or to do anything for workers, and there's no pressure on National even to be particularly right-wing any more so than Labour. So without a politicised class conflict to encourage rivalry between parties, parties essentially slip back into how they're more comfortable, just being pragmatic electoral machines. And it's also helped by the fact that political parties themselves are becoming more and more redundant. The mass parties of the left and the mass parties of the right just don't exist. National has a membership of something like 15,000 people. It used to claim about 250,000 people. So it's not even 10% of what it used to be. Labour, likewise, used to claim about 100,000 members. They now have, depending on whose count, something like 7,000 or 8,000. And so we don't actually have strong organisations that these MPs are based around. So more than ever, we have a political class and people operating as party professionals rather than any sort of representatives of their class. Now, just to finish off, I wanted to talk about some of, I guess, what I'd see as the false solutions to this dire situation. Because the left and liberals invariably come up with solutions that don't really have much to do with the class struggle to fix these problems. And they're not necessarily bad solutions, but they're not ultimately what is needed. So like in the 1990s, you had electoral reform and MMP. And I mean, I was in favour of MMP then, and to some extent I campaigned for it, but I never saw it as a solution for the system, and I don't think it has worked out. Proportional representation, according to all the literature, is supposed to produce this diverse party system with lots of different political point of views. And I think we're finding, and Nick will talk about this soon, how increasingly that's not the case at all. It's not just Labour and National, it's the Greens, it's the Māori Party, it's whoever going into that new consensus. So just as electoral reform wasn't the solution to the decay of party politics, I don't think campaign finance reform, which is the big issue of the moment, is also going to do it. Campaign finance reformers want to make changes around donations. They want to make them much more transparent. They want to put limits on how much people can donate to parties. They want tighter spending limits. They want controls on interest groups when they take part in the electoral process. Now, I actually think that most of these ideas aren't actually even progressive. But that's arguable, and we can talk about that later maybe. But more than that, they're not actually viable. They don't actually work. Wherever these policies are brought into play in other elections, they don't actually lead to honest politics, and they have a lot of perverse outcomes that are unexpected. But more than that, I just sort of want to throw in a couple of other things. First, the question of, does money in politics really matter so much? Because, I mean, it's almost a shibboleth on the left that money equals politics, and I don't actually think it is. Even if you look at things on the sort of superficial level of general elections, there's a very strong case that money plays a very small part in who wins. It's not, for example, it's not normally the biggest spending party that wins the election. You get parties with millions of dollars to spend, like ACT, have spent their money and they're not even showing up in the polls now. They're not even 1%. I mean, you can spend as much money as you want, but if you've got a crappy product that no one's interested in, it doesn't get you anywhere. Or else you can take a party like the Alliance on the left, and you'll see that when they had no money, when they first came about, they had quite a big organisation. They had a product to sell that people were interested in, and in the first election they fought, they got 18% of the vote, which is, you know, quite decent, and they did that on a few thousand dollars. Every election subsequent to that, the Alliance Party spent more and more money, so their money went up, their expenditure went up significantly, but their votes went down every election. And once they're in Parliament, they had access to literally millions of dollars of state resources, and it didn't help. So I think we have to reflect on that, whether automatically we think having millions of dollars does mean that you can buy your way into power. And there's lots of parties, even in the Parliament today, that are managed to get into Parliament without spending millions of dollars. The Greens, New Zealand First, for example. But the second issue is that I would argue, and I think Marxists in general argue, that it's not actually donations to parties that determine what the state does. It's not actually, government policies aren't really determined by a dodgy business person giving a dodgy politician $10,000, $100,000 or whatever. As Marxists, we know that the biggest determinant on the state and on governments and capitalism is the needs of capital. And it's the structural place in the economy of capitalism that leads to policies. It affects what governments can and can't do. And so I think that's much more important than what a lot of liberals argue about the relationship between business and political parties. And I mean, the obvious example in New Zealand is neoliberalism. It didn't come about due to any business donations. When Labour began the onslaught in 1984, it wasn't because they got lots of donations. Actually, they didn't even get hardly any business donations in 1984. So, I mean, the whole argument essentially falls down. And likewise, the current Labour government's adherence to neoliberal policies and their ongoing bad policies on industrial relations, I don't think it's because they get business donations. I think it's because of capitalism. So I'll hand it over to Nick.